Back in the 1960s, a debate broke out in one part of the United States about the low quality of programs that a particular television channel was showing. It got so heated in the newspapers that the director of the television company involved was forced to make a public statement. His defense can be briefly summarized in one sentence. He said, "It's the policy of this station to give the people what they want." Sounds a very reasonable argument, really, doesn't it? To our democratically conditioned way of thinking, the best way to settle any dispute is to take a vote on it. The majority should decide, give the people what they want. But this morning I want to suggest to you that that philosophy, popular though it is, and popular though it must be by very definition, is a very tragically wrong idea. Think of Oliver Cromwell, who's supposed to have retorted to one early Democrat, "Don't give the people what they want, give them what's good for them." Of course, that sort of paternalism can become an excuse for tyranny. But at least Cromwell was shrewd enough to realize that while what the majority want is important, it's not necessarily right. In fact, in a great many cases, it's most definitely wrong. Matters of value can't be decided by vote. A million people may watch Coronation Street and Crossroads each week. That doesn't make it great drama. The most popular novels on the bookshops may be those by Howard Robbins or someone like that, but that doesn't make it great literature. Of course, it's difficult to say what really does determine artistic excellence. That's the problem of the art critic. But one thing is certain, for the media to simply give the people what they want is a recipe for mediocrity every time. The very idea suggests that good taste doesn't exist, only popular taste. And what's true in regard to the arts is perhaps even more significantly true of moral and of political decisions. It may be expedient to give the people what they want. But is it wise? A million people may say a foolish thing. It doesn't stop it being foolish. It may be convenient to give the people what they want, but is it right? Because moral values can't be decided by referendum. This is the great problem with democracy. It all too quickly leads to confusion because popular opinion is confused with absolute value. It deifies the masses. Men can no longer distinguish the will of the people from the will of God. And the Bible, therefore, is full of cautionary tales to impress upon us that those two things are definitely different. Therefore, it's often fallacious to give the people what they want. If Moses had given the people what they wanted in the wilderness, they'd have all gone back to Egypt. On the other hand, it was precisely because Pilate did give the people what they want that he released Barabbas and crucified Jesus. Now, Cromwell, for all the apparent arrogance of his remark, was onto something important. What the people want and what's good for them are not at all the same thing. And it's part of the task of true statesmanship to discern the difference. And that's what we see Samuel doing in this passage we read today. We come to a critical phase of the history of Israel when she is about to change from being a tribal federation to becoming a centralized monarchy. It had huge implications for her future destiny. And Samuel was the statesman, the prophet, and the priest who was at the center of the controversy. There are three lessons I want us to learn from these two chapters. The first, the reward that comes when people want the right thing. Second, the folly that it is when people want the right thing for the wrong reason. And thirdly, the danger that it sometimes is to get what we want. You'll find the outline in your white bulletin. Let's look first at the reward that comes when people want the right thing. Look at verse 2 of chapter 7. "It was a long time, 20 years in all, that the ark remained at Kiriath Jearim, and all the people of Israel mourned and sought after the Lord." So here was a people who had been going astray. They had been wanting the wrong thing. And it took them a long while before they were ready to acknowledge that they had been wanting the wrong thing. For a start, idolatry had got a grip on their hearts. They'd started worshipping Baal and Ashtaroth, the gods of Canaan. Well, that's not surprising, really, since a major part of the ritual surrounding these fertility gods involved promiscuous sexual behavior. Anything that allows man to rationalize and excuse his lust will never fail to be popular. Even today, we have priests of Baal and Ashtaroth. Oh, they don't go by that name. Some of them solicit for prostitutes. Some of them peddle pornography. Some of them even dignify themselves by the title psychiatrist. But whatever form it comes in, it's still the worship of sex, and nothing erodes the moral fibre of a society like it. In Israel, even the clergy had been corrupted by this generally immoral atmosphere. Remember, the sons of Eli were behaving immorally. And of course, as allegiance to the God of Israel declined in favour of these other gods, the social bonds that held the nation together were seriously weakened. The book of Judges describes the period immediately preceding this time when Samuel was alive. And the book of Judges portrays for us a society that was full of violence and division, a society characterized by anarchy even. The very last verse of the book of Judges is, "Everyone did as he saw fit." In other words, they did what they wanted. Israel was running itself prior to this time on the principle, give the people what they want. But what the people wanted was wrong. God had given them his law to tell them what was right, but they were flagrantly ignoring it. And that was why, of course, God had allowed them to be conquered by their enemies. Now, those of you who've been coming regularly will recall that Israel had just suffered a catastrophic defeat at the hand of the Philistines. Her army had been stripped to ribbons, the shrine at Shiloh had been destroyed, and the sacred ark had been captured. Admittedly, it was subsequently returned by the Philistines, but the basic situation remained unaltered. Israel at this time was under enemy occupation. Many of her cities and a great deal of her territory were under Philistine domination, and so her national pride had been dealt a major blow. This verse, verse 2, tells us that God left her in that demoralized condition for 20 years. 20 years to stew in her own juice, as we say. 20 years to learn just where giving the people what they wanted can take a nation. But then at long last, the tide began to turn. Israel mourned and sought after the Lord, we read. Spiritual revival broke out, and Samuel, who had for 20 years been watching the sad spectacle of his people under God's judgment, at last got the opportunity to preach the sermon that he must have been polishing silently for a long, long while. Look at verse 3. Samuel said to the whole house of Israel, "If you're returning to the Lord with all your hearts, then rid yourselves of the foreign gods and the Ashtaroths, and commit yourselves to the Lord and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines." No people, you see, can experience the blessing of God till they stop wanting the wrong thing and start wanting the right thing, which is to serve God only. And mercifully, Israel had reached at last that point. We read in verse 4, "So the Israelites put away their Baals and Ashtaroth and served the Lord only." And there are several lessons about revival that it's worth noticing from that passage, because this is really what Israel was experiencing, a time of spiritual refreshing, a spiritual awakening, a return to God on a large scale by the whole community. I think here one lesson is worth learning is the patience that's needed in waiting for revival. But the sacred historian tells us it was a long time, 20 years. What was Samuel doing all that time, as he stood, as it were, in the wings? Well, he was praying, I guess. Praying for revival. But what a long wait he had. He was a young man when the Philistine occupation began. He was middle-aged before things began to look up. What a lesson for us in patience. If you study the history of revivals, you will find again and again that such times of spiritual awakening almost invariably come after long periods of spiritual declension, during which the patience of God's people strained to the limit. It's as if the monsoon of revival only comes after the drought of apostasy. And if that's true of revival generally, I think it's also often true of God's dealing with individuals. I always remember Monica, not personally, because she lived several hundred, if not thousand years ago. She was the mother of Augustine. She was a Christian. She longed for the salvation of her son, Augustine. But she had to watch him spend his entire youth and early manhood in reckless immorality and pagan philosophy. Not until she was an old woman did she see the conversion that she had been praying for all those years. 20 years may seem a long while to us, I suppose, to pray for something. But then the brushstrokes, you see, that God applies to the canvas of history are very frequently that thick. We read 1,000 years is as one day to him. So if you've got a deep burden of prayer for revival, whether for an individual or for a church, or even for our whole society, you may say God has not answered yet. But don't say God has not answered. It was a long time, we read. Another thing I think is worth noting about revival here is the marks of true revival. You see, Samuel says to them, if you're returning to the Lord with all your heart. He puts it conditionally, if, he says. Because, of course, there is such a thing as contrived revival. Big rallies and powerful sermons on their own mean nothing. True revival can't be organized. Samuel had to wait 20 years to preach this sermon and to have his big rally at Mizpah. For true revival is a work of God's grace in men's hearts. And it issues in major identifiable characteristics. We can notice some of them here. Samuel specifies some of them. The surrender of our idols. That's one thing that characterizes true revival. Wholehearted commitment to serve God is another one. A deep conviction of sin is another. For we read in verse 6, on that day they fasted and confessed, we have sinned against the Lord. And a new sense of dependence on God too. In verse 8 we find them saying, do not stop crying out to the Lord our God for us, that he may rescue us. Now perhaps you personally are emerging out of a time of spiritual drought. Perhaps God's awakening your soul after a period of backsliding. Well, Samuel says to you, as he said to the Israelites, if you really mean business with God, then God requires of you more than religious feelings and attendance at big meetings. You must get to the point of admitting that you've been wanting the wrong thing and start wanting the right thing. Self-will has got to be replaced by God's will in your life. It's not just emotions that matter. It's your heart. Whatever you've been centering your life around till now, your idols have got to go. The excuses you used to make for your moral failures must be replaced by a spirit of penitence and confession. The self-confidence you used to have in approaching your problems must be replaced by an attitude of humility and prayer. Most of all, God must come first in your life. Whatever the sacrifice, he demands the throne of your life. You can't know his fullest blessing till you've reached that point of commitment. If you're returning to the Lord, he says, it must be with your whole heart. This is the mark of true revival. There is no real revival without those characteristics. There's a third lesson, I think, that's interesting to note too, and it comes in verse 12. It's the lesson that a victory in revival often begins in the place of previous defeat. Look at verse 12. Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shen. He named it Ebenezer, saying, thus far the Lord has helped us. Samuel had engineered things well, you see. Having this big revival rally at Mizpah, he knew that such a large gathering would look suspicious to the Philistines. Perhaps they'd banned all public meetings anyway, certainly. Any kind of expression of resurgent nationalism among the Israelite tribes inevitably spelt revolution against them. So it was no surprise to Samuel, I guess, that the Philistine government, after a hurried cabinet meeting in verse 7, decided on making a preemptive strike before the Israelites could get organized. You see, they were dealing now with a people who had rediscovered the power of prayer. God gave them the victory. This meeting that began as a prayer meeting of confession became instead a battlefield. While Samuel was offering the sacrifice of atonement, the Lord was thundering and destroying their enemies. The Israelites routed them and slaughtered them all the way to a point below Beth-Kar. And so the Philistine occupation ended. They were still there, of course, continuing threat to Israel's security. But the humiliation of having Philistines actually present on Israelite territory was removed. And so it was worth putting up a stone to say, here we are, a great battle was fought around here a long while ago. And we want to remember it. Hitherto the Lord has helped us, Ebenezer. But do you know where Samuel chose to put that stone? No doubt it was where the battle was fought, basically. But we've come across Ebenezer before, you see, back in chapter 4. In the very first verse. Ebenezer was the place where the Israelites were defeated by the Philistines. 20 years before. Ebenezer was the place where they had lost the battle and become an occupied country. That's why Samuel set up Ebenezer there. Ebenezer had been defeated in the first, it was the place of defeat, which had turned into the place of victory. Ebenezer was the place where, foolishly, they had taken the ark in the superstitious conviction that it would bring them victory. Now Ebenezer was the place where Samuel erected his monument to the grace of God toward his people. The ruins of defeat had become the monument of victory. Thus far, the Lord has helped us. In other words, God got us back to square one here. We're not finished with the Philistines yet. They're still over there, just beyond our borders. There will be more victories needed in the future, more battles to fight, but the lost ground has been reclaimed. Dignity and self-respect restored. We've not arrived at the finishing post, but at least we're back in the race. So far, the Lord has helped us. And that may well be your experience too, for I think it's often the experience of God's people. Perhaps you once knew God's blessing, as these Israelites had known it in the past. But then worldliness has invaded your life. Idolatry has invaded your life as it had theirs. Sin has dominion over you as the Philistines had dominion over them. Well, revival means, among other things, getting back to the beginning. Where did you start going wrong? Identify the root of your rebellion. Was it that habit? That relationship? That decision? Ask him to forgive you. And ask him to turn that place of forgiveness and prayer into the place of victory. Ask him for strength to conquer, to turn the place of defeat into victory. And then write in your diary, Ebenezer, today I got back to square one by the help of God. Finally, I think there's a fourth lesson about revival that's implicit in this chapter, and that's this. There is a clear link between national prosperity and spiritual revival. You notice Samuel's promise in verse 3. Commit yourselves to the Lord and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. Now, it's the universal testimony of the Bible that prosperity is not determined ultimately by economic or military strength, but by the spiritual orientation of a people. Jesus said it. Seek first the kingdom of God, he said, and all these things will be added to you. We live in a day, I think, when many Christians seem to feel that if we're to have credibility in the world as Christians, if our message is to have credibility, then we must preach the gospel coupled with all kinds of other things, like famine relief programs and irrigation schemes. There are some people who would even say the Christians should be involved in political revolutions. Well, undoubtedly, social concern is an important element in the fulfillment of God's command to love our neighbour. But we ought not to allow such things to detract from the biblical emphasis on spiritual priorities, or to embarrass us about preaching a gospel which directed attention fundamentally at a man's relationship with God, the vertical dimension rather than the horizontal. Because these things are of just even greater importance long-term to a nation's survival than mere economic considerations. The Archbishop of Canterbury, before he was the Archbishop, and he was still Dr. Coggan, wrote this some time ago. He said, it's assumed by many that if wages are increased and working hours shortened, progress has been made in the life of a people. All too quickly the equation is made. Material prosperity equals progress. It's possible to gain the whole world and lose the soul, to reach the moon and have hell on earth, to have a home well furnished and a mind like a sewer, to feed, clothe, and educate our children, and yet so to neglect their spiritual welfare as to set their feet on the paths of destruction. There is a very real sense, I think, in which the best thing which Christians can do to work for national prosperity is to pray for national revival. For real prosperity in any nation is a byproduct of God-centered living. It's a gift. And like all other gifts, you find it not by pursuing the gift itself, but the giver. When people start wanting the right thing, they find they're also wanting what's good for them. And that's not just true of society, it's true for us as individuals too, in a more limited way. Israel found the pathway of victory over her enemies was the pathway of surrender to God. And you will find the same. God is no man's debtor. He's the rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Put God first in your life and you will not be the loser. I'm not empowered to promise you'll be wealthy, but but you will be content. I can't promise you will have no problems, but you will have peace. I do not promise there'll be no battles to be fought, but you will win them. Give the people what they want? No, no, no. One with God is a majority. Blessing doesn't begin until people start wanting the right thing. All Israel mourned and sought after the Lord. So much then for the reward that comes from seeking the right thing in this national revival. But chapter 8 takes us a bit further on in the history of the people, and it's useful, I think, to set the two in contrast. Because here we have an example of people wanting the right thing, but for the wrong reason. Look at chapter 8, verses 4 and 5. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, "You are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us such as all the other nations have." I think it was Hegel who said the only thing that we learn from history is that people do not learn from history. The revival had come and gone. Those joyous days when Samuel had set up that stone at Ebenezer were a far-off memory. He was now, we read, an old man. And with the Philistine menace still lurking on the borders of Israel, the elders of the people were concerned about the future. What's going to happen when you go, Samuel? Now, one would have thought that the great lesson of Mizpah would have been enough, that they would have learned to trust God, to give them the spiritual leadership they would need when they needed it. But the passage of time, you see, had dulled the people's spirituality again. Oh, they hadn't gone back to their idols. No, Samuel had put a stop to all that, right? But there was a worldliness about their thinking, and Samuel was quick to spot it. Look at verse 6. When they said, "Give us a king to lead us," this displeased Samuel, so he prayed to the Lord. Now, why was Samuel so suspicious of this demand for a king? Because, after all, it was a perfectly legitimate request. It's important we understand this. Moses had made provision for the appointment of a king in the national constitution. Up until this point of time, no such appointment had been necessary. Israel had been organized as a federation of tribes. When they needed to act together against an external enemy, then God had usually raised up a national leader marked out by some charisma. They called them judges, Gideon and Samson and Jephthah, Samuel even. And in the early days, that system worked quite well. But undoubtedly, Moses himself had anticipated that eventually the day would arrive when some kind of permanent central leadership would need to be established, a figurehead for national identity that would ensure effective action in the interests of national defense. And God had indicated to Moses that monarchy would be the appropriate institution. You can find out all about that in Deuteronomy chapter 17, the reference is on the white sheet. Now, if that's so, why was Samuel dubious? This is a problem that's puzzled many scholars. Indeed, some are so perplexed by it, they come to the conclusion that Samuel couldn't possibly have known about the book of Deuteronomy. Monarchy, they say, must have been a novel idea to him. So Deuteronomy can't have been written by Moses. It must be a much later book. Well, I don't think we need to engage in that kind of speculation. There are several reasons I think we can identify for Samuel's uncertainty about this demand for a king without insisting on a late date for the book of Deuteronomy. For a start, let me suggest to you a few. For a start, I think, one reason Samuel was definitely dubious about this suggestion of a king was that Samuel had a very profound lack of faith in genetics. You see, a major difference between the old system of judges and of monarchy is that a monarch established a dynasty. A judge might be succeeded by anybody or nobody. It all depended on how the Spirit of God moved. It was a highly precarious system. A king, on the other hand, could always guarantee a known successor, his firstborn son, which made it a far more reliable kind of leadership. Samuel, however, wasn't so much interested in security of succession to the national leadership as quality. When it came to quality, Samuel did not put much confidence in heredity. He knew there was no evading the consequences of original sin. The greatest saint in the world could still bear children in the image of Adam. No matter how great a portion of the Holy Spirit the father enjoyed, there was no way his son could inherit it. No doubt Samuel knew this as a theological truth from his study of Genesis. But he also knew it as a result of bitter personal experience, didn't he? First there was Eli, his mentor in the priesthood as a boy. Eli's sons had been wicked men in spite of their father's spirituality. And now we read Samuel was suffering the same tragedy in his own family, in verses 1 and 3. He appointed his sons as judges, but his sons didn't walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain. Now, a dynasty may be a good way of ensuring succession, but it's no guarantee of quality. God had ordained a hereditary priesthood in the Levites, but did God intend a dynastic monarchy for his people? It was perhaps a fine point of interpretation as far as Samuel was concerned, for though kings normally did establish dynasties, and Moses does talk about the king's descendants, Moses also said that the king of Israel must be one whom the Lord himself had chosen. How could that apply to a dynasty? What's more, Moses also said the king had to be an expert in the law of God, reading it daily and carefully following its commands. Now, could a dynasty be sure of reliably producing spiritually minded people like that? Now, with prophetic insight, Samuel perceived the failure of the monarchy in Israel long before it happened. When you read the book of Kings, what do you find? You find that they couldn't find good sons to follow good fathers. Again and again, he didn't walk in the way of his father, who was a good king. He took his example from some lesser king. Samuel could see that. Genetics can't guarantee moral and spiritual quality. Perhaps there's a lesson for us, actually, in passing. For sometimes government in churches descends to be ruled by dynasties, you know. Sometimes a man is appointed, for instance, deacon or elder because his father was one before him. I don't think Samuel would have been very much in favour of that either. The second reason why I think Samuel was dubious about this call for a king was he felt it was a personal affront. Look at verse 5. You are old and your sons don't walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us. See, there's no concealing the bluntness of the people's ingratitude there, is there? You're past it, Samuel. We need a younger man. That's what they were basically saying. No one likes getting relegated to the scrap heap, especially not a man who had faithfully served the people in the outstanding way Samuel had. And he had a lot of life left in him, actually, as subsequent events prove. Do you notice the gracious way God comforts the old man's hurt feelings in verse 7? The Lord said to him, "It's not you they have rejected as their king, but me. Don't feel too badly about it, Samuel. I, the Lord, am hurt too by their demand. For they're not asking for a king in order to obey my word, but out of a spirit of faithless rebellion against my rule. Just as they have done," he says in verse 8, "from the day I brought them out of Egypt until this day, so they are doing to you." See, Samuel, he says, you're just experiencing the kind of rejection that I've had to put up with from this people ever since Moses. Don't get bitter and twisted about it, Samuel. Swallow your pride, absorb your anger like I do. Be patient like a father with them. They'll learn one day. There's a lesson to in that, isn't there? It can be a very bitter blow when someone's promoted over our head. Or when we are forced to retire or resign, some men just can't take it. Resentment festers in their hearts. They sulk, they conspire, they whisper. Not Samuel. He could play a major role in the appointment of Israel's first two kings. Still, his feelings were hurt. And I think that partly explains his uncertainty about the people's demands. But I think the major reason why Samuel was very dubious about this demand for a king was this: that the people's motivation was wrong. Now you see the reason they give in verse 4, why they want a king. "Appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have," they said. Now this phrase is a quotation from Deuteronomy 17, verse 14. "Let us set a king over us like all the nations." In other words, the elders are reminding Samuel here that there was a constitutional provision that Moses had made. In a world which Israel was increasingly surrounded by centralized states and aggressive imperialist ambitions, Moses knew it was inevitable that she would one day need some form of centralized government. And Moses had anticipated it. So they were quoting a text, if you like, to support their case before Samuel. But unfortunately, it's quite clear that the elders of Israel hadn't paid an awful lot of attention to the rest of that passage in Deuteronomy, where Moses lays down the requirements and the institution of the monarchy. For Moses laid down there very carefully, not just that a king was permitted, but the constitutional limits on the power of the king of Israel. Let me give you some examples of that. For a start, Moses said the king mustn't have a large standing army, nor must he enter alliance with a foreign power in order to increase his personal military capability. In other words, if the king wanted to go to war, he could only do so with the consent and the support of all the other tribes. What's more, Moses said he couldn't have a harem, because Moses' view this led to an obsession with sexual self-indulgence that seduced the king from his proper task. Nor must he build up a personal fortune, thus preventing exploitative taxation. And perhaps most extraordinary of all, Moses said that the king of Israel would have no power at all, to make laws. He would get the laws from the priests who kept charge of the sacred scripture. Now, why did Moses stipulate such extensive limits to the sovereignty of the monarch? Well, I think for two pretty obvious reasons. First, because Moses knew from his own experience in the court of Pharaoh that monarchy without checks becomes tyranny. By restricting the king's power, the constitution of Israel defended the nation against the extremes of totalitarianism that were very common in the pagan world. Someone has said a government that's big enough to give us all we want is also big enough to take it all away. I suspect that Moses and many of the Old Testament prophets would have had a lot in common with Jefferson. I mean, he argued that the only way to have a good government was not to give it all to one person, to spread the power around. That's one reason, then, why Moses restricted the power of monarchy. But I think there was another reason, too, a more theological reason, if you like, rather than a political reason. Because if the power of the king weren't carefully prescribed, the basic foundation of the Israelite state would be undermined. What was that foundation? It was this: that the king of Israel was the Lord. Very interesting that Gideon, who was one of the judges, he was once encouraged by the people to form a dynastic monarchy, and he refused flatly on these grounds. "I will not rule over you," he said, "nor will my son. The Lord will rule over you." See, in the ancient world, when a king wielded absolute power, he almost inevitably became deified in the popular imagination. You see that happening even up to the time of the Roman Empire. But not in Israel. Israel was based on the idea of theocracy, the rule of God. And that's why Moses laid down so carefully that the king could not be a lawmaker, only a law enforcer. The lawmaker in Israel was the Lord. He was the real king. And the king himself, the human king, was under that law, not above it. So though Israel might in one sense have had a king like other nations, in another sense, their king would be most unlike the kings of other nations in practically every practical way, because absolute power didn't belong to him, but to the Lord. Now you see, Samuel detected, when these elders came to him and said, "We want a king like other nations," that they didn't have in mind at all the kind of very limited constitutional monarchy that God had permitted in his law. No, their image of a king was derived not from Moses at all, even though they might have been quoting a bit of Deuteronomy for convenience. Their image of a king, they had drawn from the Philistines. See, the Philistines were organized as highly centralized dictatorships. Israel was beginning to think that if she wanted to compete militarily, she would have to model her politics on theirs. And that diagnosis of what was going on is correct, I think, is confirmed by what follows. Because God tells Samuel to tell the people what this king would do. And Samuel did. We read together, he told them in no uncertain terms, didn't he? But you notice, Samuel, in telling them what the king will do that they're asking for, doesn't repeat Deuteronomy 17, doesn't give a picture of the kind of constitutional monarch that Moses had permitted. What does he do now? He portrays a despot, a king who oppresses his people, building up vast personal armies, holding huge crown lands, demanding heavy taxation and forced labour. A king who would make the people cry for relief. I don't know, perhaps Samuel in his prophetic imagination was getting a glimpse of Solomon here. Do you notice what the response of the people was in verse 19? They refused to listen. No, they said, we want a king over us. Then we shall be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and go out and before us and fight our battles. They were adamant, you see. There was no retort, oh, Samuel, you misunderstand. We don't mean that kind of king, Samuel. We want a constitutional monarchy, like the book of Deuteronomy says. No, they don't say that. For their ambition for military victory had completely blinded them to the implications of their action. They were rejecting the Lord's rule, just as they'd done years before when they turned to Baal to Ashtaroth. No more did they put their faith for victory in prayer. Now, we want a king to fight our battles, like the Philistines have got. A king like all the other nations. So you see, here is a classic example of the people of God being conformed to the world. Technically, what they wanted was right. But they wanted it for the wrong reason. We want a king, they said. Perhaps you've been wanting something. A new house. A new car. Job promotion. All perhaps quite legitimate. Right things to want. But why do you want them? That's the question. Perhaps you've been seeking God in prayer for some special blessing. For healing, maybe. Or for a spiritual gift. Or for a boyfriend, or for a girlfriend, or for a baby. All perfectly according to God's word. But why do you want it? See, it's tragically possible to want the right thing for the wrong reason. To rationalize worldly ambitions by finding a text that allows it. Don't you remember how the devil quoted the Bible to encourage Jesus to jump from the temple? You see, the motive would have been wrong. What's your motive? Is it self-display? Is it prestige? Is it respectability? Is it security? Or is it you just want to be the same as others? As Israel did. You're not prepared to let God order your path and make your choices for you. You're not willing to make him your king. It's the old story again, isn't it? Give the people what they want. You're moving with the herd. Going with the crowd. The tyranny of fashion rules you. You just can't bear to be different. Mrs. Jones down the road has got a new colour TV. We've got to get one, George. Jennifer's got a new boyfriend. I'd better have one. Bob speaks in tongues now. I want to. Jesus said there are only two ways, the broad and the narrow. And if you follow the crowd, you will find yourself on the broad way. If you want to walk the way to life, you must be prepared to walk on your own. Do not be conformed to the world, says the apostle, but be transformed. If you're a Christian, you're going to be different. You're going to look and possibly feel conspicuous. You may be mocked, it's part of the deal, because being holy means being different, being distinctive. Making God your king means kneeling in the garden of suffering and saying, not what I want, but what you want. Any desire we have, no matter how superficially laudable and spiritual it may appear, that doesn't derive from that root of submission to the rule of God, is worldliness and sin. And that's what was wrong with these people here. They wanted the right thing. But it did not derive from a sense of submission to the rule of God. So when you formulate your aims and ambitions, take my advice and be less concerned with what you want and more concerned with why you want it. But if you want the right thing for the wrong reason, you're heading for spiritual disaster. Very briefly, just notice, will you, the third and final heading we have. The danger of getting what we want. Verse 21. When Samuel heard all that the people said, he repeated it before the Lord, and the Lord answered, listen to them, and give them a king. See, when we seek for something that's not good for us, God will frequently say no. He will deny us. He won't give us a snake. even if we ask him. You ask and do not receive, says James, because you ask amiss. You're wrongly motivated to spend it on your passions. But some people won't take no for an answer. They pester God for what they want, and not in a spirit of godly perseverance, but in a spirit of worldly obstinacy. We want a king, they said. They refuse to be corrected. And I suggest to you that if you persist in your misplaced ambition, you may find God gives you what you want. The only way some people will learn. You know what the result of this decision was, don't you? King Saul, we should be studying him next week, one of the most pathetic and tragic figures in the whole history of Israel. If only they'd waited. David was probably a babe in arms at this time, but he would grow. God had got his eye on him. If only they'd been patient, as Samuel had been patient all those 20 years, waiting for God's moment. But no, commit your way to the Lord, trust in him, he will bring it to pass, not for them. This people would force God's hand. So God gave them what they wanted. He may give you what you want. Better be sure you want the right thing, and that you want it for the right reason. Ask him amiss, often enough, defiantly enough, and he may say yes. Why, if people reject his kingly rule long enough, he will even give them hell. Because that's what they want. Give the people what they want? No, God forbid. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done. Let's pray together.